And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3,797 of the Survival Podcast. That makes tomorrow 98 and Thursday 3,799. That means we will not hit 3,800 this week. We'll hit it next week on Monday. Anyway, just kind of a, whenever I hit like a zero at the end of an episode or a 50, I always feel like we've done something, another milestone, so to say, in the timeline of TSP. What are we going to talk about today? Well, we're going to build on yesterday's show. I try to keep the show very much a variety show, with different things, on a daily basis so that it doesn't become like a one hit type thing. But this time of year, I have the avalanche of emails coming in that's all centered around the same stuff, which is basically spring is springing and I need to be sprung with spring and I need my garden and I want to know what should I plant and what kind of bush and what kind of seeds and what kind of beds and what kind of fertility. And it's just that time. And the people that don't realize it's that time are going to be like, about two more weeks from now, holy shit, it was that time 2 weeks ago and now I'm behind. That's what always happens in the, you know, midwinter as you head towards spring. You start having to think about, like, when do you set plants out in your climate? And for some of you, that's like mid-April. And so you have more time. But even in that case, you know, like my grandpa's place was in central Pennsylvania. When did he drop dead date by which he would have his peppers and tomatoes started? Valentine's Day, which is what, 4 days away, guys, don't forget. It'll kick you in the ass if you do, right? But, you know, by Valentine's Day, he was in USDA Zone 6. I'm sitting down here in 8, 7 or 8, depending on exactly where the line falls at any given time that they redistrict everything. And you know, it's going to be February 14th. I can put plants out often mid-March. That's not the best practice, but if I hit March 15 and I look in the 10-day forecast and nothing even gets close to freezing, I'm going for it. I'm putting them in. That means like we're a month away for like half the country from setting out plants. And at best, you're a month and a half to 2 months, depending on where you are, unless you're like in Alaska or something, you know? So we got to start thinking about it. Now, the thing that always comes is raised beds. I want to build raised beds. And what about treated lumber? What about cinder blocks? What about rocks I have laying around the house? What about old scrap wood? How do I make the wood last without using treated lumber? And like tons of, what do I use for fill? How deep does it need to be? What should the dimensions be? And even though today's entire show is really geared toward how to make great raised beds work for you, I want to turn that all around on its head right from the gate and say the first question we should be asking is, do you need, as in require, for them to function well, raised beds on your land? There's a few reasons that could be the case. But the first question is, do we need it? Not is it nice to have, not does it look pretty, but do we need it here? Okay. And then the second question would be, if we don't need it, are the justifications for why we want it sufficient that we should do it? Because I'm going to tell you that if I think back to like the 1980s when I was taking care of my granddad's garden, and like every third house where I grew up had a garden. And when I say a garden, I don't mean a little tiny patch. I mean a proper subsistence garden, because it was a poor area. Old timers, almost all the old folks that were there had lived through the Depression, the Victory Gardens of World War II, all of it. So everybody did it. I never saw a raised bed in my life. In the 1980s, in Pennsylvania anyway. Saw a few in Florida before we moved up there. Sand and whatnot, you know. I never, ever saw a raised bed. And if I did see something that was kind of a raised bed, it was more like a non-structure mounded bed. It was really an in-ground bed, but it had been built up over the years to where it was kind of more like your market garden looking stuff. And why? because raised beds cost money to build. Raised beds take money to build. And people that are growing food because they need food don't spend money they don't have to spend. That would be one of the reasons. And then the other side of it is there's a lot of places where it's just not needed. And there's a lot of places where it's not even advantageous. So if you tuned in only to learn about how to make raised beds today, you're going to get that, but you're also going to get more. You're going to get a way to evaluate. And I want you to start using this word differently than we tend to use it today. If we went back even 100 years, people use this word entirely differently than we use it today, because today we're always thinking about computers and phones and cameras and, you know, when we say technology. But everything that humans have ever assembled on one level or another is a technology. When a chimpanzee uses the most basic form of tool making and takes a stick and shoves it into a termite mound and pulls it out and eats the termites, that is technology. That is technology. So is this the right technology for your application? And the reason I think it's important to use the word technology is, one, because it's accurate. But two, there's something about that word. There's enough power in that word that when you phrase it that way, your mind says, oh, that actually seems like a reasonable question. If I just said, should you have raised beds? Oh, I should have whatever I want. Do you need raised beds? Well, I want them, so yeah. Right? But if I say, is it the proper technology for your situation? Your mind probably at that point says, well, like, I think it is. And that's exactly where we want to be. I think. Because then if we think, we can think through and we can make a determination. One, is this right? Two, does it make sense? And three, if it does, how should I do it? And that way, even if you don't need it, but you want it anyway, you make decisions based on what is actually important for you. And you know the limitations you create for yourself, and thereby you can mitigate them. So for instance, me, I have two reasons for raised beds. Actually, I have like 50 reasons in one hand, and that's these feathered creatures that run around and mess with everything. So by having very high raised beds, my raised beds are 2 feet high minimum, ducks don't cause me problems. But I would probably, at least for the main garden area, go a different way and just fence out the ducks and do in-ground beds here, except for the fact I don't have enough dirt. I'm effectively gardening on top of a parking lot covered in 4 to 6 inches of dirt. Not what you want to do, you know? So since that's the case, because of that rock layer that I have, and it's, for those who don't know, it's not chunk rock. It is slab limestone. I'm sitting on a slab. And because of that, I have to do that. So even when the answer is yes, this is what you need. If you don't understand the limitations they create, if you didn't need them, you can't mitigate those considerations where you do, and it leads to problems. So anyway, I think everybody will get what they're looking for, but we're going to come at this from a much deeper thought level than you typically get in a podcast or video or what have you of something like this. Before we do that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Nothing about gardens in the sponsorships today. The sponsor of the day, number one, is Above Phone. They have a really great sale going on right now for Valentine's Day. Above Phone is one way that you can take back your tech from the big providers. They have phones, tablets, and computers that all run on open source customized operating systems that do not let the device manufacturer, your internet service provider, your phone provider, etc., spy on you, harvest your data, and sell your data. And if you're thinking, but can I really, like, this is, sounds high tech, do I need to be a computer nerd or something? No. If you can use a computer now, if you can use a phone now, if you can use a tablet now, you can use the stuff at Above Phone. It may take a little bit of a learning curve. Let me tell you what I mean by that, though. You ever pick up somebody else's phone and they have the same phone you do, and all they really have is, like, the icons are different, and at first you're like, what the hell is this? It's weird, isn't it? Right? It's just so muscle. It's more like that than actually learning something new. It's just kind of reassociating yourself with, like, layout and stuff like that, maybe using some different apps. If you need to use an app from Google Play or the iTunes Store because you cannot find an open source app that comes with these devices, you still can, and you can actually put it in a jail where it only does the things that it does when you let it. It's really cool, and they'll even give you an expert for an hour phone call to onboard you to your new device. So really anybody can do this. Check them out today at abovephone.com. Next up today, much easier thing to explain. Biltong USA from Anton's Land of Biltong. I love this stuff. I get paid by Anton in Biltong and Calvinazzi and Drew Wurz and Biltong sticks. I really do. He pays me in product, and I'm happy to take it. That's how much I love his Biltong and his other products. He also has a lot of stuff that he imports from all over the world, not just South Africa. Some really cool stuff. So check the site out, BiltongUSA.com. The only warning I have for you is if you start eating it, you may not be able to stop. It really is that good. And it, again, it's real Biltong. Most of the stuff that you can buy in a bag today, it says Biltong on it. I don't know what you actually call it, but it ain't Biltong. Biltong and jerky are different things. They're made different ways with different seasoning, and they have a different kind of way that they hit. And the stuff that is Biltong tends to be extremely expensive. I'm talking, you know, like you feel like you're buying drugs by the ounce expensive. And Anton's is very reasonable for what it is. So check it out again, BiltongUSA.com. All right, with that, let's go ahead and get into it. So I want to start off with, instead of even, do we need raised beds? If we're going to evaluate this as thinking beings, right, which is what we should do with anything that has significant effort behind it, or we're going to rely on for food. And then, so in this case, both, right? Money, effort, time, and food dependence. This is an important thing. So the first question that we should ask is, what are the goals of a garden? And moreover, what should they be? I mean, what are we actually trying to do when we put a garden? I want to grow food. Yeah, but isn't there a little more to it? Number one, we want to grow plants. We want to grow plants. Any garden, even if it's not a vegetable garden, without plants, it's not a garden, right? So we want to be able to grow plants. Today we're looking at food, but plants are plants. We could be putting in a garden that is more of something to attract pollinators or just for beauty or medicinal herbs. Or it could be more of a visual barrier. There's a lot of reasons. So the number one purpose, we want to grow plants. So if we do something that doesn't help us grow plants, that actually takes effort or money, then we're applying effort and money that's actually counter to our goal. So just a very simple way to start out. Next, we want to optimize the growth of what we want versus the growth that would naturally happen in that spot. In other words, if you don't do anything, unless you're talking about an absolute bare parking lot, and even in time that will change, it will have sediment build up and things crack and things will start growing. We've all seen it, right? But if we do nothing to a place that most people put a garden, something's going to grow there. And that means if we make it more optimum for growth for tomatoes and peppers or herbs or flowers or whatever, we're also going to make it more optimum for growth for a lot of other plants. Now, if we get our fertility high enough, a lot of weed pressure goes away, but there's other plants that we think of as weeds that are happy to grow there too. So whatever we do, we need to be doing it in a standpoint that allows us to follow the principle of to favor what we want in the absence of what we don't want, to guild out the weed, right? And I don't really believe there's, I heard somebody one time in the permaculture space, I don't remember who said it, but they said something like there's no such thing as a weed, which you know, Jeff Lott and Bill Mollison have all said that. But this person then added on, however, there are plants that will choke out the plants you want to grow. I think it was Dave Jackie, actually. And that's true. So we want to make sure that we are doing things in a way that guild out the things we don't want and favor the things that we do want. We also want to minimize our workload. Nobody's like, you know what I want to do, man? I'm going to put in a garden just so I can work an extra 40 hours a week, because 40 hours a week at my office is not enough, right? What we're trying to do is exchange a small amount of labor for a relatively high amount of beauty or medicinal value or food. In other words, if I expend 20,000 calories to produce 18,000 calories, unless I'm a fat ass that needs to lose weight, I would be better off having done nothing. So I want to minimize the labor relative to the output, right? The bigger the garden, the more output, the more labor there will be. But that ratio should stay that my small amount of work is doing a relatively large amount of production. of one thing or another. And then I want to give organization to chaos. I bet you've never heard anybody, but maybe if I've heard me talk about this before, describe it that way. But that's what a garden is the organizing of chaos. And that's back to, if you don't plant anything, other things will grow. So once you start planting things, you have to manage them so that doesn't happen. And humans relate to patterns. And so we have patterns like, we're going to take our pepper plants and space them 24 inches apart minimum. That way they can spread out and grow to their full size. And when they do and they come out and touch and they create shade underneath, that alone minimizes the weeds. That is one piece of the pattern. Raised beds fit into that because when I create defined bed space, it makes it very easy for me to know, don't let anything grow here. This is my border edge, let's say, and I've laid down some sort of weed blocker and maybe some sort of, you know, mulch, right, on top of that so it looks nice. Over here's lawn, mow it, and over here's garden, maintain it. But one way or another, whenever we put in a garden, we're creating a management structure, a pattern that we now can relate to, just like an ant does. Really? An ant? Yeah. I mean, think about, you ever seen the things where they like melt aluminum and they pour it in the ant mound and it makes art, but it's really like all these, that's a pattern. And that ant in that chamber knows, okay, this is a brood chamber. This is a food storage chamber. This is a ventilation shaft, just by the way it looks. Now, you're not going to figure that out. I don't want to be a subterranean ant. But that's how the garden works for us. We just look at certain areas and go, okay, this is the area for the taller plants in the back. This is where the trellis is for the beans, right? This is a border where everything on the other side of this is going to be aromatics, and then everything on this side is going to be fruit-producing vegetables, whatever that is. We want to create that structure for ourselves. Give organization to chaos. So what are, when we start looking at raised beds, what are the advantages of raised beds? Probably the biggest advantage is actually not what people think it is, because it ends up being kind of expensive unless you just have great soil to work with in the beginning, which might mean you don't need raised beds in the first place. But it's complete control over your quote-unquote soil mix. So when I dig up a garden bed using like a double dig method or something like that, I don't do raised beds. Basically, I cut the sod off, turn the soil over once, and define myself a bed. And this is exactly what I did when I was a kid working for my grandpa. We had these great long rows, 50 foot long, 3 foot wide, with a 3 foot strip of grass in between them. And he wanted them straight. So every year I would take a string that we kept with a nail and a stick, and we put it in one corner and ran it 50 feet down the other end of the bed to the other corner. I took a tool called an edger, which is basically like, it looked like a hoe that didn't bend. It was just like straightened out, like people use them for breaking ice too. And I would edge all the way down and then go 3 foot across and 50 foot back up and 3 foot across. That was the first thing you did, is you cut wherever the weeds, grass, sod had already infringed over that winter season. And then we dug that and buried all the green material underneath, and then that gave you a nice fresh bed to plant into. It was basically tilling with a shovel. And I dug 10 of those beds every year. From the time I was about 9 years old, I dug 10 of those beds every year. It's a lot of work. And with a raised bed, you won't have to do that. If you don't let it get taken over, you know, it's pretty much the next season, you just plant back into it. Maybe you pull a few weeds out to pop up. So by having control of that soil mix, you start weed-free, usually disease-free from any of your soil-based pathogens, and you don't have, like, it's easier to fill a bed than dig a bed, at least the first time, right? Now, the difference is you fill the bed, and then you don't have to do the work ever again, so it becomes even more the case that the raised bed has the advantage there on a labor-saving standpoint. You get good drainage. Part of that's the soil mix you put in, but the other part of that is simply by raising up the bed, you create more downward pressure on the water that's in the soil, so you're less likely to have soggy, wet feet in your garden. And there are probably as many gardens that fail due to being too wet as there are to too dry. In fact, I would tell you that for many places and many people, their garden being too wet is more likely the problem than being too dry. If you live in North Central Texas and it's August, that's not going to be the case. But I would say probably 50% of the country, you have a real potential to be overly wet and hence anaerobic, wet feet, you call it. It's not good. So raised beds are, if you have that problem, they're a great answer to that problem. You also have a clear demarcation point. Garden, lawn, there's no confusion about it. There's no ripple. There's a straight edge. And like I said, and we'll get more into this in construction, it makes a lot of sense to have that bed sitting down and then have maybe 3 foot or 4 foot of weed blocker right up to the edge of that bed and then have that mulched with something like wood chips, which break down every season and then can be shoveled into the bed for the next season and replaced. And that'll keep not only the weeds around your bed nice for working and everything, but it'll create a lot less infiltration into them from things like runner grasses and clumping grasses. But even if you don't do that, it's really clear, like, this is the garden, this is the lawn. It's very, very useful for a maintenance standpoint, especially if you're having children, spouses, friends assist. It gives them a very clear line, like, this is the spot to work on. They're also easy to install irrigation during construction. No dig, right? Might have to do a little digging to get some leveling done or something, but let's say we have our beds laid out and we do run a feeder pipe from our irrigation source to it, but now we want to put in, you know, irrigation in all the beds. Any piping that needs to be underneath the soil, under the bed, just lay it on the ground, and when you fill the bed, it gets covered. And, you know, everybody has their own irrigation scheme, so that can, you know, be really helpful or a little helpful, but either way, it's easy. If you do it when you build the beds, it's very easy to do. And there's, you know, some other things. One, like, if you have, no matter how low they are, you have to bend less to reach the soil level. You know, my beds are at 2 feet, and I have this little bench, this little folding bench from the floor. And I can work all the way around my gardens. And when I sit down, it's like sitting at this desk here, like it's right there in front of me. And that's really nice when I'm doing transplants, right? It's one thing when I'm harvesting or whatever, it's not as big of a deal. But when you're like, I can set the bench here and I'm going to do 1, 2, 3, 4 transplants before I have to move the bench. And it's literally like working at a desk. That's really nice. That's really, it keeps it up out of, you know, maybe you have livestock that are not, like chickens will fly up in anyway, but ducks, you're over 2 feet, they just don't bother. And I've even seen, you know, raised beds that are more like basically a container maybe, and up as high as 3 or 4 feet, so people can stand and work them. I consider that more container gardening, but, you know, you do you. It all depends. Now, what do you think? Okay, there's all this great stuff. I told you I wanted them, Jack. Well, what are the disadvantages? There is no such thing of a thing that requires any effort and does anything meaningful that has no disadvantages. Everything's a trade-off in life. Somebody will figure something out. I don't know what, but it can prove me wrong, but I'm always back to the bell curve. I'm in this. When I say that, I'm in the 80 percentile, and your 1 percentile way over there isn't really what I'm talking about. So here's some disadvantages. First of all, they cost money. There's a cost to construction materials. I figured out that a 4 foot by 8 foot by 2 foot bed built out of the regular plain old plain Jane pressure treated lumber from Lowe's Home Depot is in the neighborhood of $140-$160, depending on what lumber is selling for that week. That's not insignificant. And it may mean that the first year of crop out of that bed is a net zero gain on money. I'm not saying that to do it, but you get what I'm saying. Like $160 worth of produce is quite a bit of produce, especially if you didn't need the bed to do it. Okay. Actually, the item of the day today is a galvanized metal bed that's much more affordable, but still, it's a cost, right? And you have to do the work to put it in place versus just dig a spot up. Right. Again, if I go back and I think to people that actually gardened for food because they needed to on some level, I never saw a raised bed. And if I did, it was made out of like native rock or something like that, which can have its own issues because it's not perfectly straight. You get all kinds of edge, and edge is where you produce weeds. Edge is where you produce everything. So it also is where you produce weeds. Cost of fill material. Now, if you have great soil, which would be one reason you might not need a raised bed in the first place, maybe it's free, and maybe you're doing some excavation and you have some really great topsoil, some really deep topsoil. Patrick Rohrman, when they got their new farm, he sent me a picture when they did some excavation. He was down 2 feet. He was still looking at beautiful topsoil before they hit like subsoil. So yeah, so that would be a big pile of great soil, and I got to put it somewhere. I can either just spread it out or I can fill beds with it. Okay, now my cost is down. It still has to be moved. There's a labor cost. There's a physical cost. If I have to rent a piece of equipment, there's that cost if it's I'm putting a lot of them in. So one way or another, the fill costs money. But if you have to actually buy in your fill, you might find that it costs you more to fill a raised bed, like 1 to 2 foot of depth, than it does to build it. Because they used to say cheap is dirt. Yeah, dirt's cheap, but soil's not. And you don't want dirt. Maybe you want dirt that you can improve the soil. And there's a lot of ways to mitigate this. I tend to, in my 2 foot beds, the first 10 inches usually wood chips that I get for free. That takes up volume, but it's also a form of hugelkultur and organic matter hit. And it has a lot of advantages. So I tend to do that. I don't mix it in. I literally fill that first about 8 to 10 inches with wood chips. I saturate them with some fertility and then I cover them up and I let them decompose naturally. And I keep adding to the top every season with new compost, but it's still a cost. And you might not be able to get your wood chips free or whatever. And you still have another foot to fill. So there's a cost of fill. It also, it does have great drainage, but you know what that means? It means it dries out faster in hot climates. That's why if I had good soil here, I'd be far more likely to put the money I put into building beds into building a fenced off garden. And I would have my gardens in the ground. And as hot as it gets here, I might even take a tip from the Hopi Indians in the desert where they actually did what you call pit gardening. They literally dug the bed down. So when you came up to your garden bed, you'd have it like straight, sheer, like a little mini cliff, like 6 inches in the ground. And then your vegetables are a little bit below grade. That helps with wind, but it also helps keep them more moist in these dry climates. So I'm doing this in spite of the fact that it actually is a negative for me that you dry out quicker. And I'm compensating for that by going very, very, you know, again, about 24 inches of depth in that bed and really great soil that I've cultivated. It holds the moisture really well. But initially, since you get better drainage and because you're higher up and you're more subject to evaporation, including from edges, you will dry out quicker, which can be a benefit or a detriment depending on your climate. So you need to think about this. It initially requires more labor. Digging a garden, I mean, you can go rent a little mini rototiller for the first time, and man, you can put in a garden quick with very little effort the first time relative to building a bed, filling it, mulching it, planting it. But it's only the first time because you're going to have to repeat in-ground beds. You're going to have to, on some level, repeat that process annually. With raised beds, it's much more easy to maintain, where like the most we're doing is maybe putting down a cover crop in winter and terminating in spring and then replanting. It's just easier to do that eventually, but it is more work up front. And they are at least, I would say, semi-permanent structures. I hesitate to call anything that's, you know, a couple foot high or lower that's not built out of concrete permanent. If you decide you don't want a bed and it's built out of 2x6s or something like that, and you did it with a screw gun, you can pretty much zip the screws out of it, take the wood away, and spread it out. So it's not permanent, but it's somewhat permanent. And moving it tends to be a pain in the ass. So now you, once you've made a decision on where you're going to put that thing, it's a pretty heroic effort to decide, I really should have put it on the east fence line instead of the west fence line, if you get my drift. So those are your disadvantages to consider. Now let's talk about material for building these. probably the most cost-effective material to use today if you're going to build your own and you don't have anything you can just source from your own property or source for free with scavenging or whatever is probably good old-fashioned landscape timbers. That's what I've used. I don't think they quite look as good as something like, you know, taking 4x4s for your corners and then building a box out of, let's say, 2x6 pressed treated lumber. But they look pretty damn good. They last fairly well. Everybody freaks out about treated wood. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. And then if you're still doing it, bad boy, stop it. You're being asinine. You don't know why you're worried about this other than somebody told you to. Because if you understood the chemicals used in the treatment and you understood how plants work, you'd understand there's zero risk of anything, that you are going to get way more toxins in your body by going to your front door, breathe deeply through your nose and out your mouth 3 times, and you've just inhaled and processed more toxins than you'll ever get from a treated piece of lumber, especially today. Which, by the way, is part of why it doesn't work as good as it used to. It has arsenic in it. You actually used to. Very small amount ever got in the soil. Never enough to be a problem for human beings' diets. But all the shrieking, they took it away years ago. And now there's no arsenic. And it's mostly copper that's in the treatments today. Even the old treatment, which worked better, was no risk. Right? So you get longevity by having treated lumber. You can increase that longevity with any kind of lumber by doing things like putting half cinders underneath the bed and setting it on top of that, and avoiding that ground contact. And then whenever I build raised beds out of timber, I take weed blocker and I line the sides with weed blocker. It extends the life about 10 years. Just because even though it's wet and all the soil is not in that direct contact, it also prevents, if there's any gaps or anything, dirt moving through, and it just works better. Just trust me, okay? But landscape timbers and treated lumber are the most commonly used things. A lot of people will go out and get like scrap wood and all that's untreated, and that's fine, and it might cost no money, but generally I have found an irrigated garden bed built out of untreated 2x6s or something like that will completely rot through in 2 to 3 seasons. If you don't mind rebuilding it every 2 to 3 seasons with the free wood you can go get, like in Mel Bartholomew's book, what he says, go ahead and do it. Not me. I want something to last, you know, a decade or more. And again, treated lumber, line the insides with landscape fabric, heavy landscape fabric. Just once you get your bed done, roll it out, staple it. It doesn't have to be held really well, because once you put the dirt will hold it against the sidewalls. Cinder blocks or other man-made hardscape materials. That's probably better. It may not look as nice. I don't think cinder block beds look that great. I've even seen them painted and all, and they don't tend to really look nice. But depending on where the garden is or how you design it, that might work for you. More like landscaping stones and things like that will work and look better. The issue is, as soon as you move into that, unless you're in a more of a brick shape, as long as you have any curvature, any softness, it looks nicer, but you create edge and you're back to weeds infiltrating. Which brings me to my next material, which is natural stone and rock and things like that. I've built these too, and they're fine, and it's free, and that's good. It's free from a dollar concept. You have to still go physical labor to put rocks together. But anything that creates a jagged edge creates more infiltration points for grasses and weeds and clumping herbs and things like that to infiltrate into your garden. So just be aware of that. The more edge you have, the more productivity along the edge, and the more things you need to deal with from a maintenance standpoint. And then my last one is metal garden beds. And these can be like the item of the day I'm going to give you today is from a company called Vavor. And I've also got one from a company called Frizone, where it's more like a galvanized steel. You bolt it together and you put it on the ground and do it. But I've also seen people, you know, use like roofing metal and things like that. Sometimes they get for next to nothing. And maybe they're using a little bit of wood in the framework, but That wood, if it begins to rot in here, spot there, spot, it's easy to replace. And I've seen some very affordable and some really good looking beds made out of things like corrugated roofing material and stuff like that, especially from like salvaged material. Like the guy takes it down, he knows it's worth something, but it's not really going to be good for roofing again because the holes are never going to line up the same way or whatever. And man, I'm telling you, if you can find somebody like that, that's a great material to build your raised beds out of. Let me give you my rules for raised beds. Width, 4 feet. That's the answer. That's how wide they need to be. Unless you could give me a compelling reason otherwise. If I have a friend of mine who just did a pretty cool looking keyhole design in his backyard. It's basically two rows of raised beds with one way to get in the center. And from the pictures he sent me today, the video he sent me today, it looks like they're about 3 foot wide. I totally get it because it's kind of got the fence behind it. I don't think he can get behind the backside. Had I might have actually pushed that off the fence wide enough for the lawnmower to go back there, but you built it now, man. And maybe he did. Maybe I just didn't realize it. But I think his beds are 3 foot wide, and that's because that fence, one, it's on the fence side, you would have a hard time reaching from the other side. So 3 feet, you can it might be a little bit of a stretch, but you can definitely reach across 3 feet. 4 feet, 2 feet of reach is perfect. So your 4 foot width is your classic, what you call double reach bed. I can reach every spot in the bed from one side or the other comfortably when I'm harvesting, when I'm working, when I'm planting. Yes, I can reach 3 feet, but not comfortably. But just about any full-size human, right, all but little bitty kids, 2 foot of reach is very comfortable working reach. So if you are doing something where I'm lining up with something and I can't get the other side, it's going to be more narrow. I am going to be very unlikely to ever make a bed 5-6 foot wide. 4 foot is kind of optimum. So that's my first rule. The next is if your ground really sucks like mine does, go deep. Mitigate that problem that it will dry out faster by having more volume to work with. So I would never grow 1 foot deep raised beds on this property because I did when I moved in 2013, quick setup, temporary situation, and it sucked. It became very difficult to keep those beds fully hydrated with a single daily irrigation in the summer. Now with 2 feet, it's no problem. And 2 feet with the soil that I've built over 10 years, it's not even a thing. Like I can actually skip a day of watering in all but the absolute hottest, most brutal days of summer. With a 1 foot bed, there is no day. I would say from late May to late September, I would have to irrigate every day unless it rained that day and rained significantly. So it's the case that deeper will be better if you have bad soils, if you need to mitigate the fact that they dry out faster. Right. Ironically, if you have wet soils, going higher also is a solution. So it's a good solution for not draining too fast, but it's also a good solution for not draining fast enough. And you might just consider different things in your soil mixture, depending on the situation you're trying to contend with. Be sure of your location before you build it. Really think about it. Really look at it. Is this going to be easy to maintain? You know, if you're like, I can get water to the spot, get water to the spot before you build it, be sure. If you're going to use power with like timers or something like that, get power to the spot before you build it. Like really think about it. I don't think it's going too far to take something like kite string and some stakes or some sticks and mark out where your beds are going to be and make an outline with white string that you can easily see. Set it up. I mean, this is if you haven't done anything yet, right? Set it up. Walk away from it. Don't stand there staring at it. Leave it alone for a day. The next day, go back to the spot and look at it. Do you still like it? Now, don't get there like you're so wound up the ass you can't poop a BB that's greased, right? And be analysis paralysis. But at least like, you're going to live with that choice. If you're spacing it off a building, a wall, a fence, be sure it's got enough space. I would tell you, If your push mower won't fit in that space, it's too close. If when you're back there, you feel cramped at all, it's too close. You're better off giving up a little bit more space to work behind things. I have plenty of things, not just raised beds, but plenty of things that are in places where I wish I would have allowed myself more rear space. So think about that spacing as well. Be sure a raised bed really makes sense, right? I know I kind of covered that already, but that last check is, does this really make sense? Is this really what I want to put here? Because let me be clear. You don't need a raised bed, but it looks pretty according to your significant other, and you're going to be able to have your garden and not worry about shit. Do it. As long as there's not enough negative to offset that, right? You just like raised beds, do it. You have a design, and that design flows really beautifully from a visual aesthetic with straight line edges. Do it. You can get the material for nothing, and you like the idea. Do it. But at least ask the question, does this make sense, or am I doing it because of all the people I saw do it on YouTube and I have a vision of something that may never be a reality? By the way, this is for all the shit you do on your property, period. Where you're going to put a pond, where you're going to put a trellis, where you put anything that takes more than an hour to move and change like it never happened. Think, does this really make sense? And the next thing is employ weed blockers. My primary garden, this is something I wish I had done. Jack, I thought you just said you put weed block all the way. I did. You know what I didn't do? I didn't lay it down on the ground and then build the beds on top of weed blocker. If you're going more than a foot of depth, that's what I would advise. If you're, you know, 6-inch depth, you're doing like little shallow raised beds, I'd be back to, why are you doing this? Is this really what you need to be doing? That type of thing. But at that point, like, you only have 6 inches of depth and you really need those plants to get into your native soil to have enough root depth, right? And eventually they will grow through there, but your first season they probably wouldn't. But if you have like an 18-inch, 2-foot raised bed like I do, right, then lay that shit down, put it on top. You're not going to have any infiltration for at least a few seasons. And even when you do, it's going to be much easier to deal with from things like runner grasses and stuff like that. So if you ask me what is the one thing you would have done different when you put in my 4-bed primary garden, which is huge because each bed is a big wing. It's like a right angle if you've not seen them. So the back sides of them are 12 feet by 12 feet in a 90-degree angle, and then 8 foot by 8 foot on the front side and 4 foot of width. And my biggest regret with that garden, in fact, my only regret with that garden, is that I did not put weed blocker under those beds, because doing it now is not tenable. It really isn't. There's just no good way to do it. All you can do now is lay it down alongside of it, and that could help some. But I know it will only help so much, so I haven't done it yet. But if I could just, you know, do like a snap in reverse time, I would do two things. I would put weed blocker under my guard and buy a fuckload more Bitcoin. Those are the two big changes I'd make over the last 10 years anyway. Next, get over your fear of treated lumber, or don't use wood. I already gave you my soliloquy on treated lumber and why it doesn't matter. And part of why it doesn't matter is that many things that you don't want to eat in your plants, for that plant to get that thing into their body is energetic. In other words, they have to give up something to get it. They need to partner with a microbe, with the exudate process or something like that. Even things that can be toxic to plants, but they need a little bit of it, like let's say zinc, work that way. And so unless you have a massive amount of zinc in soil, then you'll actually burn the roots of plants. But if you have like more than you would want, the plant's not going to take it up anyway, unless you're looking at a soil pH of like 4.5 to 4.8, where the plant is kind of forced to drink it because it's literally being acid eaten by the pH of the soil. Well, if you have a 4. Anything pH, you have other problems, right? You don't have to worry about your garden being toxic because you're not going to grow much other than maybe blueberries. So that's it's not that big of a deal to begin with. But if everything I've said doesn't convince you yet that it's okay to use pressure-treated lumber, then don't use wood. Then use rock. Then use hardscape. Then use metal. Then do an in-ground bed. I don't know what to tell you, but don't use wood because you're just going to have to redo the work in a couple, three seasons. Now, does this have limits? Yeah, I would draw the line at things like railroad ties. Like when you have creosote, just when the sun hits railroad ties, it just pours out. That's a different world to me. I'm not going to do that. If I was adverse to using wood, I would probably also be adverse to using tires, but that's another thing that there's no reason to be adverse of. I would probably get big, giant trucker tires and build basically raised beds out of tires before I would use untreated lumber, because it's just, you're going to have to redo the work. Next, consider heavy mulch and weed blocking around and in between beds, additional to the underlayment, which would make the most sense. That way you have kind of this barrier that weeds have to get across. And because of that, you get a lot less of this kind of climbing up into and through into your bed, because things like, you know, Bermuda grass or St. Augustine grasses, things that have runners, that can infiltrate, and things that grow from rhizomes. You think you pulled it all out, but a couple little rhizome pieces stayed in your, and it just keeps coming back, and it keeps coming back, and it keeps coming back. The more we can do to suppress that, the better off we would be. On bed orientation, fill material and location. These are kind of more rules. My number one rule is if you can't see it, you won't take care of it. Unless you're really dedicated, or it just doesn't work to put it where you can see it. And that would be me. I'm just breaking my own rule. My garden is off to the side of my back shop. From my porch, you can't see it. I'm out there every day, though. And I've set my property up to kind of make me have to go out there every day. What I'm cautioning you against is, well, I'm going to put the garden way out by the back fence, because then the wife won't complain about it. It won't be in the way. I won't see it. And what will happen is, you won't spend enough time with your garden. You won't notice your problems. You'll have things die. If automated irrigation fails, you won't know until your plants are dead. Pest problems, weed problems, everything will be worse. And it's just a vegetable garden like we're talking about, from a permaculture design perspective, is best kept a zone one item, maybe zone two. So if you're not familiar with zones in permaculture, there's really six primary zones, even though it goes up to number five because it starts with zero. Zero is inside your house. Zone one is right when you step outside of your house. And everything directly around it and every place that you step on at least once a day. You know, if you got up and left the house, you walked on that piece of land, it's ideal for zone one. So again, if you have to put something further out, you can design pathways so that, like, if I have to take a walk out to, let's say, a shop every day for whatever reason that's built into your life, maybe you run a home business, then anything around that shop becomes part of the zone one, where for maybe another person it wouldn't be. Or you can put your garden, like if you have your chicken coop further away from your house than would typically be a zone one, because you don't want your chickens right next to your house. As long as you protect the garden from the chickens, you can put the garden out there with the chickens. And now every morning when you go out to let them out, you observe the garden. But if you can't see it, you won't take care of it. And when you don't take care of something that's biological, things grow that shouldn't grow and die that should not die. And I'll leave it at that for you. Ideal locations, it just a little temperance here. Central Pennsylvania, full sun all day long is probably the best for most of your plants, okay? But in a lot of the country, if your plants suffer in summer during full sun, you're like nirvana point, morning sun, afternoon shade. If you have a place that, like, right when the sun comes up, the sun's right on it, those plants get about 6 to 9 hours of sun. And on those long 14-hour days, like the end of the day, those plants are almost completely shaded. That is nirvana bliss. That is, so when we're trying to figure out where to put these, if I have that choice and I have to make myself go look at it every day, which is exactly where I'm at, okay? Or I can see it, but it's going to bake all day in the sun. Then I'll give up the seeing it in return for the solar exposure. And again, this is subjective to your geography. Pay attention to what's around you. Pay attention to what works for other people. What kind of setup do the people that have the active happy gardens have? Because this is what I mean by this. In Texas, if you get sun all day, it will flat murder even a marigold. Okay? I mean, it will murder it. Like that marigold will be like, I quit. I'm dying. I'm going away. Even if it's watered well. Because we've done it here, and they by August need some shade at some part of the day. Yeah? Okay. When we lived in Pennsylvania, my wife loves marigolds. So we had this huge flower bed out in front of the house. And nice landscaping, looked very suburban, you know, nice round kidney shape, mulched every year. And she planted a marigold about every 2 feet, the big ones, and they would spread out. It's just beautiful all summer long. There was a corner where the eve of the house casted a shadow for about the last 2 hours of the day. Okay? So you're getting a good 8 hours of sun on that spot every day. 2 hours of shade relative to all the other marigolds. They looked like dog shit compared to the other ones. They were smaller, weaker, not as vibrant, not as healthy. So in that climate, full sun was the way. In this climate, full sun is the death, right? The plant can only take so much solar radiation at a time before it goes into a transpiration cycle where it's literally sweating. It's moving water through it as fast as it can because it's overburdened by the amount of photosynthetic and radiation activity. And so you balance that. But I'm going to tell you, for most of you, afternoon sun is the way to go. And you're better off with morning sun and afternoon shade than morning shade and afternoon sun if you have the choice in those climate types. Next, wind can be your enemy for many reasons. So setting up wind blocks is a good idea, including temporary wind block capability. So here's what I mean by this. Like, middle of the summer, wind here is not, it's irrelevant. It can add to evaporation and all, but we don't get much wind. And once that plant is established, unless it's like a really bad thunderstorm with like 80 mile an hour winds, it's not a big deal. But about 3 or 4 weeks from right now, and most of March and at least part of April, Dallas is truly the windy city. We are windier than Chicago that calls itself the windy city. And so you take this little pepper plant, it's got like 6 true leaves on it, and you stick it out there, and you harden it up, and it's starting to grow, and it's getting some new leaf growth, and you're all happy, and then you get a day of just sustained winds of like 20 miles an hour. And that little plant's out there going, like a friggin' flag on the back of a pickup truck. And by the end of that day, it's just tattered, torn, and effed up. And even if it lives, you just set it back a week in its growth cycle. You did all that work, and it's now set back. So one of the ways that I will deal with this is I will just take and put, let's say, 4x4 posts in the beds for overhead supports and all. But that's a great place. And you can just take some cheap, thin plywood, cut it in strips, maybe 8 inches wide. So that'll give you 8 inches of wind block. And then you can take and just, with a screw gun, pop it up so that it's on the predominant windward side so that when that wind blows, that wind is then forced up over those plants. And once you get through that vulnerable thing, you just take it down, throw it back in your storage room. And it doesn't take up much space that way. You can make, you know, 8 of them out of one piece of plywood. But 4 foot, 8 inches, not 8 of them, would you make like 6 of them? 6 strips. Or whatever else you, I mean, if you can plant permanent wind block, that may be beneficial. If you can set the beds relative, like where I set mine, my wind during that time of year is predominantly west to east. And it, when it's taking the track of north or south, it's going to be north. It's going to grow from the west to the southeast or to the northeast, right? It's going to cross, but it's going to be prominently to the west. I have a shop building, an 800-foot shop building that is just to the west of the garden that blocks the shit out of the wind. And I have trees to the front side that blocks the southern wind. So about the only thing that can hit that garden from sustained winds, we have to have a sustained wind from the northeast. Because even due east is blocked by some other trees and stuff. This almost never happens. And when it does, we've got a bad weather event coming in anyway, a nor'easter, right? So think about how you can put that positioning in tandem with other things you create as wind blocks or that already exist that will be wind blocks. So in my case, I've got a building that's functioning as a wind block, a microclimate creator, and creating afternoon shade on the garden at the time that it needs it most. I didn't put the building there to do that. The building was there, so I located the garden in that spot. Does that make sense? This is how you have to think through this to get the optimum results for what's available to you, right? I can't say you'll get the same results as me. You might get better results. You might get worse. You have to work with what you have. But this is how to think through that. A 50-50 mix of screened topsoil and compost is probably your best starting point if you have to go commercial. You have to buy in your fill. So almost no matter where you are in the country, you will be able to get those two things. A commercially produced compost and a commercially, you know, buy by the yard screen topsoil. Is this what I recommend? No. I don't have another option. I get it. I had to do that. My bed started out exactly that way. I didn't recommend it, and I still did it. Why? It's what I could do. It's what I could get. There's no place here I don't have any dirt to spare. There was no place to take anything from. So again, my 2-foot beds, I went about 10, 11 inches of wood chips, and then a mixture of 50-50 topsoil and compost on top of that. And I was able to get a truck to pull right in my field and dump it there and then rent a Bobcat for a day and dump it in. Okay? But that's not what I wanted to do. But that would be your last ditch. I don't really have another choice. Some people literally build soil in the bed itself with layered organic matter, especially those using the metal frame beds. I've had a lot of people do that. This is not instant gratification, though. But I've had a lot of people that basically they'll set up a metal bed in the fall and they'll start composting in it. They'll throw all their organic matter in there. And maybe it's a 2-foot deep bed. And maybe the first spring it's only, 60% full. But they'll garden in it like that and basically have a wind blocker now, as long as it's not too shaded, right? As long as it gets enough sun. And then at the end of that season, they'll do it again. And by the second season, that even a 2-foot bed, it can be relatively full. And you've composted in place. And you've created the soil 100% from your own action. The issue with that, that's 100% compost, and that might sound really good, but in general, you want some sand or silt or clay material mixed in with that. Like, it's not just a pure compost, right? For optimum structure of your soil. So it's up to you. There's worse things to grow in the pure compost, though. Just be careful with your commercial compost. Most of it's not very good. A lot of it has residual herbicides. A lot of it was never finished. A lot of it was over composted. That's actually a thing you can do. A lot of it gets way too hot during the commercial processes because of the volumes they're making and the way that they're doing it. Look at it like this. No matter how good, and I'm not even talking about seed oils and GMOs and shit. I don't care. Let's go back to 1950. And you got Wonder Bread and you got Grandma's Bread. Which one do you really want to eat? Which one tastes better? Grandma's, right? Grandma is an artisan. Wonder Bread is a mass-produced product. The best compost you can find is no better than 1950s Wonder Bread. It won't kill you. And you can make it really good eventually, but it's not where you want to start if you don't have to. If you have soil on property, by all means, use it and improve it. That would be best. If you have a place where you can take decent topsoil from, drop it into your raised bed, if you have areas you can scrape because you're doing other work, and I would tell you this, like, let's say you're going to put in something and it's going to require scraping off about 4 inches of dirt. If it's good at all, stockpile it somewhere. Don't just spread it out. There'll probably come a time when you wish you had it. and dirt costs money. Again, it's no longer dirt is no longer dirt cheap. a lot of things aren't dirt cheap anymore, right? I mean, I had to buy some PVC recently, and I have some 1-inch Schedule 40, and it's like $8 a stick for 1-inch PVC. Like that's 3-inch price from, you know, 10 years ago, or maybe 2-inch price from 10 years ago. Like, what the hell? And fittings don't even get me started. So dirt is not dirt cheap. PVC is not dirt cheap. Nothing's dirt cheap anymore, I guess. Managing your garden. Just want to give you a little bit on that today, because that's kind of like how to select, decide, build, and think about structure. And if you have questions, you haven't gotten them to me yet. I've got 4 of them starred. So the word question in all caps in the chat, put that for me, and then give me your question in 1 sentence, and then any details you want after the question, and I'll do Q&A here in just a minute. But managing your garden, number 1, weed early and weed often. You know, weed your garden like Democrats vote, early and often, right? The more you weed, the less you'll weed. Let me say that again. The more you weed, the less you'll weed. If you go out to your garden every day and anything that you see that looks like a weed, just pick it out and drop it on the soil surface, it'll seem really easy to do. If you do it once a week, it'll be kind of a chore, but it's not so bad. Yeah. If you do it every 2 weeks, you'll hate your life. You'll hate your life. Most organic farmers on like market garden scale, they put more labor into weeding than anything else. It's a funny thing, though. Good soil fertility and soil management already reduces weed pressure. If you do the other things, including the things I didn't do for myself, like weed blocker at the bottom of the beds, and you don't get runner grasses in, it becomes really easy for the size garden most homesteaders actually need and want to have, you know, even if it's 10 raised beds, right? If you, with 10 raised beds, think about it this way. If you simply say every day, I'm going to weed 2 beds. I'll weed beds 1 and 2 on Monday, 3 and 4 on Tuesday, etc. By the end of the week, you're already overlapping. You're less than 1 week in between. And if they're 8-foot by 4-foot beds, how long does it take? Not very long. It is when you say, I don't need to do it. I'll get to it next weekend. And next weekend, the kid has a softball game. And you go do that. And like, it's been 3 weeks. And you're like, what have I done? And then you start having these mixed weeds and deep roots and things that don't just pull out. The soil compacts more. The weeds hold the soil together more. Because if you take that practice of like every few days, each bed gets weeded once at least. By the time you get into full growth for your summer, you're not going to have much of a weed problem. So again, weed your garden like Democrats vote early and often. Keep records of what grows and when things happen. You should be able to look at a garden journal if you've gardened for, you know, 5-6 seasons or more and say, every year, assuming I get the tomatoes in by this date, my first major flowering event, like not one blossom here or there, you'd note that too, but like when you see like all the plants have blossoms, is always this around by this week. My first fruit sets this week, my first harvest of, you know, anything more than one off is going to be about here. And that it, when my frost, my late, when did my late frost happen over the last 5 seasons? You know, when did I get screwed? When do I really need to be careful about pushing the edge of being early? When did I, you know, when does the first big rains come? When does the rain stop for the year, for the summer? When do I go from, yeah, I have plenty of rain to I really need to irrigate? All those types of things. When I planted 3 different tomatoes, which one produced best? Oh, I'll remember that. Yeah, you will. In September of the year it happens. You won't remember it 3 Septembers from now, which one was best that year, and you won't have a benchmark to know this new thing you found, is it really better than that was 3 years ago? Like, what kind of pests are you seeing? When do they show up? Journal all of this. This is general good gardening advice. The more you journal like that, the more you'll be in touch with your land, the more you're accepting feedback, which is a primary permaculture principle, right? Observation and acceptance of feedback. That's one of David Holmgren's 12 primary principles of permaculture. The journaling takes it to another level because the feedback remains current even when it's ancient. Because I don't know about you guys, but as I get older, what happened yesterday, I still remember pretty well, but what happened 5 years ago, I don't remember that shit the way that I did. When I was 25, I could almost tell you every day of my freaking life when I was a 20-year-old what happened. Right? If you ask me to now what happened last week, I know it all, but I don't know if it really was last week or the week before that or yesterday. So the more we write down, and then the more we're actually being able to send forward to our children, our grandchildren, and things like that. I wish I could tell you that I learned that from my grandfather. My grandfather was much more of a, I know all it, I need to know up here guy. I can't tell you how treasured of a memory it would be if I had Biff Spirico's freaking garden journal and I could see what he was writing down about his garden, you know, in 1950, only 5 years after he had gotten back from World War II. I would probably have made a copy of it, and the original would probably be sealed up and in a safe deposit box or something. That's how priceless that would be to me. So I know it's hard to think about yourself that way, but God willing, someday you'll be somebody's great great grandfather who's passed on. And what legacy are you leaving behind? That's a question I tell you to ask about a lot of things. This is an easy one. This is an easy one to create a legacy. Irrigate on a schedule. That's another thing my grandfather was, you know, first of all, Pennsylvania is just a much more forgiving climate. And always know that I am speaking with some bias from my climate. I'll put it this way. My intern, Josiah, when I first moved to this house, he was here about 3 weeks. He said, everything in this place wants to bite me, sting me, or stab me, and the sun wants to kill me. That was his exact quote. He's like, everything here's trying to hurt me or kill me. And so this is a harsh climate with that. So my irrigation is pretty much daily. And when it gets really hot, it's like morning and afternoon irrigation. And that's why I do what I call a modified drip, where the water never gets on the plants. I have pipes that lay on the surface, and they shoot water out tiny little holes on the side. It's kind of like drip, except it doesn't drip. It's more like it's like light pea irrigation, right? It's what it kind of is, like the final like little bit of arc left to it. So it doesn't cause any damage to the soil or what have you. But you know, it's better that you have a schedule on your irrigation, because that way, if I leave, I can just say, hey, whoever's watching my house, every morning after you take care of the ducks, walk out to the garden, make sure nothing's going to die or broken or anything like that, and turn all the timers to 20 minutes and walk away. And because I have a schedule and I figured out that that's how much I can do every day that gives the garden all that it needs and never overdoes it, even if it happens to rain and they weren't sure, just do it anyway, then I can walk away and do that. And once I have that schedule, even though mine is, I call it fully semi-automatic, right? Fully semi-automated, because you have to manually turn the timers. There's nothing that prevents me now from putting some sort of powered timer out there that does it for me. And I need a schedule for that to work. Or I need something like, if I get really sophisticated with automation, I've got like moisture probes and it knows when the moisture level goes below X. That's still a schedule. It's just a climate determined schedule versus a time determined schedule. But have a schedule. It will make everything easier. And when you realize you're overwatering, you can look at your schedule and figure where to cut back. And if you figure you're not watering sufficiently, you can look at your schedule and figure out, like, does that mean I need to just extend my duration, or do I need to have multiple waterings and multiple irrigations during this time of year per season? Because I figured that out, like taking my 20-minute morning watering in August and making it 30 minutes or even 40 minutes and doubling it didn't really solve the problem. But doing it 20 minutes in the morning and just doing it 10 minutes about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, perfect. And you'll only know that if you're managing it by a schedule, okay? And if you live somewhere that you're like, I don't even have to irrigate, maybe if we go a couple weeks without rain, I take the garden hose out. I grew up like that. Again, that's fine. But for everybody else, put your irrigation on a schedule. fertilize on a schedule, and that's totally on you. So when I say fertilize, I don't just mean fertilizer. That could be that, you know, twice a year you add compost. That could be that once a month during your growing season, you go out in the evening with a compost extract and you spray your plants, right? That could be that you do green manure made with comfrey and other herbs, and you do a soil drench with that twice a season. Whatever it is that you do from a standpoint of fertility, and I really should say pest mitigation mixed in with this, put that on a schedule. Things that are on schedules tend to happen, and things that are not on schedules tend to be forgotten. Way, way back, nothing to do with gardening directly here. Way back when I was in the corporate world, I realized there were times when my wife and I said, well, next Saturday we're going to go out, or we're going to go do this thing or whatever it is. And not only I would forget it and be in trouble when she remembered, but there were times we both would be like, hey, weren't we supposed to do something today? And it's like 6 p.m. now. And like, we were supposed to do it at like 1:00. Oh, shit. But somehow I could be in Boston one day dealing with clients there. And I already knew that the next day I was going to have to drive down to New York City and meet with somebody, let's say at 4:00 in the evening for an early dinner. And it was going to be a contractor, an architect, and a wholesaler. They're going to put together in a meeting. And somehow, if that was going to happen at 4:00, at 3:45 at the latest, I was standing in the front of that restaurant talking to the host and making sure that everything was understood, and that when I sat down, I never had to worry about anybody else picking up the pay, the check or any of that shit. They knew not even to give it to them. They knew who was coming. They knew what I wanted, what my preferences were. Everything happened exactly on time the way it should. And you know how I knew where to go that next day? I would, that's how long ago it is, open my Palm Pilot. Dear Grandpa, tell us about your Palm Pilot, right? Opened up my Palm Pilot next to my onion that I wore on my belt, which was the style of the time. There's a pop culture break. And I would look in there on my calendar thing. We didn't even call them apps, but I guess it was an app. And I have to leave here tonight because I have to be there tomorrow, and I would be there. So I started putting things like our date nights on my calendar. She was not amused. She was, you should, you forget too. We're not supposed to remember that you forget too, right? And but what I ended up saying was, look, do you think you're less important to me than that client in New York City? Well, no, of course not. Okay, well then if they go on my calendar, why shouldn't you go on my calendar? Oh, it's like that. If it's important, schedule it, because then it'll probably happen. Okay. So fertilization and pest management schedules for your standard operational things. Harvest frequently. Harvest frequently. You know, I think it's a weird thing, but I have found that a lot of gardeners tend to get less production because they want to wait for more. Like a tomato only gets so ripe, pick it. Beans are a classic example, though. If you're growing like bush beans, like green beans or wax beans or whatever, once they start producing for that season, you should be out there like every few days harvesting. And the more you harvest, the more they'll produce. If you don't pick them, the plant says, hey, the next generation's in the bag. Especially as those beans begin to mature beyond where you want them for optimum consumption. That's where they're optimum to be a dry bean or to be seed for the next generation. That plant's like, I got it. When you're constantly pulling those young pods off that plant, it's kind of like there's some weird animal out here. And I'm trying to ensure, I'm a bean. I got to ensure the survival of the species, right? And I don't have any babies. Somebody stole them. I got to make more babies. You get more. A lot of vegetables that you like are cut and come again, greens and stuff, the more you cut them, the more fresh greens they grow. They literally actually become a bigger, stockier plant by harvesting them. So I'm not saying take everything to the ground, for Christ's sake, but especially things that produce more than one time, harvest frequently and you'll end up with more total yield, not less. Certain things don't get any bigger and they don't get any better. And as my friend David always says, everything tastes better as a baby. I don't know if that's completely true because a little baby green tomato is not very good. But like greens and things like that, he's right. Baby carrots are sweeter than big giant carrots. So it's okay to harvest things a little bit young if it's appropriate to do, right? I don't want to harvest a young cucumber that's this big and tastes like a rock. But within that limitation, the more you harvest, the more you'll tend to get, including things like sometimes pruning things. It's really not harvesting for yourself, but like once my peppers get really established, I prune them up about 6 inches. There's not a branch on them down to the soil, minimum 6 inches. That lets airflow underneath. It also just encourages more of this kind of bushy growth of this plant. And it also makes it easier to see weeds and to pull them out, right? So think that way. Harvest frequently, you get more production. And no matter the techniques, no matter the plants, no matter what, the soil is the key. The soil is always the key. Everything's about the soil. You are not a gardener. You are a soil manager. The soil needs to be managed so the garden will produce for itself, right? You don't make a pepper plant make a pepper. Right. Peppers are one of the plants that there are wild peppers that we grow in gardens that look the same in the wild as they do in the garden. There's a lot of man-created peppers and selectively bred, but in the and a lot of those peppers that are selectively bred, that plant will, if it drops a pod somewhere in the woods and it's a suitable place, it'll grow and it'll produce another pepper, and that plant will produce another plant and it'll keep going. Right. In other words, the plant knows what it's doing. It doesn't need you. Plants don't need us. Billions of years, there were plants and no people. You got me? But what plants always need, no matter what, you know, tillandsias and air plants and stuff. Okay. You're being the guy with the glasses. Well, actually, right? No. In general, plants that grow in soil need good soil for them. There's even like, well, this grows in poor soil. No, it grows in outstanding soil, outstandingly well, but that plant's adapted to that soil type, right? In general, good soil has a good percentage of organic matter. It's well-drained. It's got good structure. And so if you really want to understand soil, I recommend you actually take my course on cover crops. Because even if you're like, I don't know if I ever really am going to do a cover crop, or I just throw a handful of shit in there and it works. And yeah, that's fine. But that course will, in the words of Billy Bond, who spent over $5,000 to take a course on soils from Elaine Ingham. So this is his words, not mine. I learned more in your course in the first half of it about soil that actually matters than her course, which was over $5,000. Now, he's not saying anything bad about her, and there's things that she would learn in her course, like figuring out the exact microbes to cultivate, to grow the exact crop. I don't go there. But soil, an understanding of soil biology and soil hydrology and soil care, that little $80 course on cover crops, it's probably worth more than $80 just for the soil knowledge if you leave the cover crops out of it. So if you want to know more about caring for soil, take that course. And I'd say the compost course is only $40, and it teaches you a hell of a lot about soil biology and structure and microbiology in the soil as well. Those are available at homefoodsystems.com, and MSB members, you get a discount. Instead of final thoughts, let me just go ahead and take some questions, because this one, well, it's an hour and 18. That's not too bad. But if you have any more questions and you don't see your question here, then go ahead and get them in. I'll do one more round after I get through these. Annie says, I put quail manure and rabbit bedding in my raised beds a few weeks ago. How long do you think it will be before it's safe to plant into? About 30 days from the day you did it. For the quail manure. Quail manure is hot. It needs some time, and it depends on how much, and was it bound up with carb, like it was in bedding and stuff like that, but about 30 days, it'll be fine. Don't do that while you're actively growing. And quail manure is not known as the best fertility aid, but I have found compost made from it to be damn good. It usually needs a pretty good hit of carbon added to it because the carbon that it's bound up in is really saturated because they make a lot of waste. The rabbit manure, you can put rabbit manure right next to your tomato plant while it's growing. It's what's called a cool manure. So it's only the quail that you're worried about. And, you know, if you, I don't till. So when I say till here, I don't mean till like, but I mean like with a little, like your rake or a little turnover with a trowel or a shovel, but moving it into the soil a little bit to make sure that it gets good contact would be even better. And as your soil warms up, your soil biology is going to warm up. And I mean, worms and other critters are going to take that down really quick for you and process it through their guts. But I would say minimum 30 days. And when I say safe, yeah, maybe there's some contamination risk if you're growing a green that you're going to eat without washing that's in direct contact with the ground. If you're growing peppers, tomatoes, eggplants, et cetera, and shit like that, there's no really foodborne illness risk from that at all, you know, even a couple weeks into it. The problem is you can have some problems with like too much nitrogen, burning roots and things like that. When you first put it down, it's what they refer to as being too hot of a manure for it not to have been composted first. Underground fly. What is your take on scorching lumber, the Japanese style? Hey man, if you want to do that, go ahead. I don't think it does much for treated lumber. I think it's much more an untreated lumber thing. It's a method of treatment is what it is. And it's pretty damn good for insect resistance and general rot resistance. I don't know that it does a flipping thing for ground contact. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I'm not sure. But I don't think it does anything about that. I think that everything I said about the chemicals in treated lumber is true. But I don't know if it's a good idea to be burning them and breathing in the smoke off put by that. So go ahead and do it if you want to, but I wouldn't do it with treated lumber is my answer there. Dark Horse, want to do raised bed, but limited tight space in back and steep yard. You probably don't want to do a true raised bed. I'm not sure exactly what you will need to do. And of course, he's already got another question where he's changed his entire situation. I think this guy has multiple personality disorder, but for some reason I like him anyway. But let's talk about the steep thing you can do with steep. One of the things you can do there is you basically put in like logs on contour, okay, and then go upgrade from that log and then cut into the bank and flip it over and fill. So the log, so you take a log, let's say 4 inches. And if we go straight back at the hill that we say is steep, maybe it's 2 feet back before that becomes level. Okay. And we flip that in. And now we have a terrace. Maybe this is something I can do. If I had a whiteboard, I could do this maybe a little bit better for you. But again, think of it this way. You've got steep hill, like my hand. And again, if you're in audio, I'm sorry. This is the best I can do here. You'll have to come over and follow the video. And then I must log here. Okay. And I have that log like that, and that is the front of my terrace. And I go in and I flip this over. I take this part of the dirt and I flip it over. And now I have a flat area of maybe 3 feet, a 3 foot single reach from the front bed. And then I can do a little path like that down in front. And that's what I walk on. And then the next level down, I do my next bed. That's one way we've done that working with steep slopes. Again, you got to figure out like limited space. You're probably better off container garden. Let's see what he said next when he completely changed his world. Never mind. We'll just need to clear some bushes against the apartment. I fat fingered before I could finish forming my question. Okay, whatever. It's an apartment, dude. Container gardens, whiskey barrels, things like that. IBC totes, if you can get away with it, even if you wrap them with like the bamboo shit mats that make it look pretty or something. I would look toward apartments. I would look more toward container, and it depends on your management and whatever, but I don't know. Second Life Farm, you live within an hour of a large city. You can almost certainly get OMRI listed compost delivered. Triaxial dump load, usually $1,000 to $1,800. It's worth it. OMRI means it is suitable for using an organic for cultivation. If I was going to buy in that much compost, and I'm not saying I wouldn't do it because I actually did, I would shop all my options and look at the inputs they use to make their compost and the process by which they do it. And I would try to pick the best of them all. And I would pay a little bit more for one that's a little bit better if I can do that. Because like some of the places, they'll say it's OMRI. And, okay, great. Yeah, it just means it's qualified. But you'll find out like, well, what's it being made with? Sewer solids from the treatment plant. And my problem with that is the pharmaceutical residue in that alone is freaking ridiculous. So just be careful with what your source is when you're buying in material, especially at that quantity. Question, what are your thoughts on buying burying weed blocker around an in-ground bed to block deeper weed roots? So I guess this is like a retrofit question you're asking me. So this would be, we go in, maybe we cut like a trench right along the edge of the bed, and then we knocked off that connection from your runners into your bed, and you're laying down weed blocker and reburying it? Or are you talking about maybe digging like subterranean, maybe an inch or two up under the bed and trying to tuck it in? I mean, if you can make it work, you can make it work. But I think that most people, especially if you have a wooden bed frame that you've built your beds and you didn't do what I didn't do, probably the best thing you can do is lay your weed blocker down right up against it, fold it up with a break in it of like maybe coming 2 inches up the bed and staple it to the bed itself, and then lay down whatever, you know, gravel, wood chips, whatever it is you're going to put for your pathways and spaces. And that way you're not really going to get any more climb in, and then you just have to deal with what's already in the bed. It would just be better to not have to retrofit it at all. I've thought about doing what I just said to my own, and I'm not convinced it will help me at this point. I think I have rhizomes directly under the bed, and now with rhizome little shit all the way up on the inside, up against the edge where it can survive and has enough airflow. And so that sucks for me. So don't do it to yourself. You don't have to. Question, in what ways can a jumbo wall calendar be used in these early seed planning and project planning days? I don't know. I guess he means like you have a big like whiteboard calendar that you write your shit on. I mean, I would use that. Like, I don't know what makes, if I'm not understanding something here, Hendrix, restate the question, because it's just calendar planning when you're going to plan all your things out. And so if I'm missing something in what you're asking me, please restate that for me, and I will get to it. I'm looking. I don't see any more questions. So I think that's knocked out all the questions. I'm going to go ahead and close up, and I'm going to come back and check the questions in case Hendrix or anybody else has any last minute questions for today. I'll hit those after we go through our closing stuff. Closing item number one today. If you haven't picked up a copy of my book, Laws of Life, please do so. If you have picked up a copy and you thought, man, I think this could really help some people, think about who those people are and pick up a copy and give it to them. This book is the philosophy by which I built the life that I have today. The way I built not just the Survival Podcast, but everything I did from the time I was a kid that left my little hometown in Pennsylvania and went on this amazing ride that created this amazing life. I had no advantages as we think of them in society. I didn't come from a wealthy family by a long shot. I didn't have a good childhood by a long shot. I never went to college. It was just not right for me. It's not that I bashed college like people think. It just wasn't right for me. So I had no credentials, nobody to rely on, nothing. And I came here in 1993. I worked as a bouncer in a bar. I worked part-time busting tires at a Firestone. Those are the kind of odd jobs I did. I worked in a warehouse packing boxes. It took me about a year to claw my way into the telecom field and build a career from there. And so that's how I started. I was out of the Army, but no one cared. It didn't matter. The only skill I had from the Army really that was something you could put down on paper was being a mechanic. And I didn't want to do that anymore. And somehow this all worked out the way that it did. Well, it's the stuff in this book. the stuff that I knew by that point, because I always was interested in investing in my future. But the things that I then learned from that point over the next 5-6 years, as I dedicated myself to becoming the best version of me I could, I took all of those things and put it into this book. If there is a perfect demographic for it, it is young people 15 to 35. If you have anybody like that in your life you care about, consider picking up a copy of this book for them. And then my item of the day today, you can find it at tspaz.com or thesurvivalpodcast.com, fits today's show perfectly. Vivor galvanized raised garden beds. These were made in multiple sizes. And kind of the two most popular are the 4 foot wide, 8 foot long. Both sizes are those dimensions, but they're either 1 foot deep, and it's like 11.8 inches, right? Or 23.6 inches, 1 foot deep or 2 foot deep. And a lot of you guys love the 2 foot. I've sold way more 2 footers than I have 1 footers over the years that I've worked with before. I always say, consider the 1 footers. And here's what happened today. I put this out. They were in stock, all of them. And about an hour after I put them out on social media, somebody said, hey, unfortunately, the 2 foot deep ones are sold out. I'm like, bullshit. So they are. They're sold out. So they must not have had very many in inventory. And probably as soon as I put it out, a few sold and knocked the inventory to zero. So they have the 1 foot deep 4x8s. Again, I think for most of you, if you don't know why you're doing 2 feet, don't do it. It'll save you money both in the cost of the material and the fill material. And 1 foot high is fine for a raised bed. However, if you do need 2 feet, since somebody did clue me into them selling out right before, I added this inventory alert. And there's a couple options you can take here. And it looks like I didn't link to one of them. So I'll add that link now. But Vivor makes an 80 inch by 40 inch by 19 inch, which is about 6.5 foot by 3.5 foot as a footprint, and then about 20 inches deep. Those are about $80. That's a good deal too. And then Frezone, F-R-E-Z-O-N-E on Amazon, they make one that I sold a ton of before I found the Vivor ones. They're 8 foot by 4 foot. The only issue with those is they have a rounded end, which actually makes them more structurally sound, but you lose a little bit of planting space by having round corners. If you think about having the round corner versus having a square corner, you gain a little bit more surface area, which is one of the reasons I like the square beds. And they're just easier for me. They're easy to line up, maintain. The design with straight designs tends to work a little bit better, in my opinion. But the Frezone ones are on sale for like $100. If you're looking at these things, is it 4 foot by 8 foot by 2 foot? It ships in a flat little box. They send all the bolts and nuts that you need for them. And they ship in a flat square box. You take the panels and you put them together. It's a two-beer job to put one bed together. So check these things out. I think you'll really like them. And what I say in the write-up on them, and this is true, you can't build one out of wood for what you can buy one of these for anymore. And these will last longer than even pressure-treated wood because metal just outlasts wood. We all know that. So check them out. And, again, I don't see any new questions here. At all. I don't see anything on that calendar question at all. So I don't really have anything there. And we have Slack Tide checking in from X. I don't get a lot of comments coming in from X. It was only a few weeks ago that I could start streaming on X again. I don't know why they took that away from me. And then customer service said it works. And I'm like, no, it doesn't. It doesn't work. It doesn't even have a button for me to stream. It's gone. They said, you're wrong. And I sent them a screenshot and they're like, yeah, it should be there. I try a different browser. Yeah, I did that. Right? I'm not a boomer, assholes. I'm Gen X. I know to use a different browser. Like, it's not there. It's not working. All of a sudden, it tried it one day, and it just came back on like magic. So I'm also on X with the live streams. Guys, thanks for tuning in today. And if you're getting ready to get ready for your gardening season in 2026, you're already behind. You should be getting ready, not getting ready to get ready. It is going to come so fast. And if you're planning on putting in new beds, I know this seems crazy, but if there's not snow and ice on the ground, the time is now. And if there is snow and ice on the ground, then you should have all the material, whatever it is you're going to, whether it's these, you know, prefab ones, like we have our item of the day today, or whether it's like stone that you're going to put together like a mason, or whether it's wood and you're going to bolt it together, you should have all the material. and the day the spot is available, put it together, fill it up, and start fine-tuning that soil, because we're a month to a month and a half in 90% of the country from it being time to put stuff in the ground. And, you know, when you're a little kid in school, a month left of school before summer vacation, it seems like forever. You get a little older, a little more perspective, you realize, like, a month is nothing. A month is, like, that fast, and it's, like, what? I mean, it's February 10th, 2026. Tick-tock. The clock ticks for us all, including for our gardens. With that, I'll catch you guys tomorrow with a great interview. Some of you are going to love tomorrow's interview. Some of you are going to hate it. Who's coming on? Former member of the Goose Group, Peter Quinones, is coming on tomorrow. We're going to talk about all this crazy shit going on in the world. And if you think occasionally I piss you off in that world, I have a feeling Pete's really going to piss some of you guys off. With that, have a great day. I'll catch you tomorrow with Pete, and we'll talk about the crazy loopy shit today or tomorrow, which is why we didn't do any of that on Monday or Tuesday.
They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.